The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Richard Lee.
Welcome. I'm Shelley Hitz, the author and owner of self-publishing-coach.com. And
I'm going to show you what you we can, in a brief amount of time, how to self-publish. We'll also talk a little bit about the differences between the traditional publishing industry, indie publishing, and then self-publishing also, so you know the differences.
Hi, I'm Steve. Welcome to a tutorial from Novel Help for Me. Today's topic is the self-publishing roadmap or process. We're going to cover the process, one that every self-publishing author needs to understand.
As the movement grows bigger, it feels like we're in the middle of the 60s, you know, something really revolutionary is happening, and it's incredibly exciting to be part of that.
Self-publishing podcast, episode number 75.
Welcome to the self-publishing podcast, where if you want something done right, you've got to do it yourself.
The revolutions just keep coming in the world of books. In what seems like the blink of an eye, supermarkets have installed bestsellers at the checkout, internet booksellers have wired your computer directly up to their warehouse, and battery-powered books have brought the bookshop into the bedroom. But perhaps the most radical transformation of all is only just beginning. In the old days, if you wanted to publish a book, you'd have to find someone else willing to take the risk of printing it, binding it and putting it in bookshops, or pay for all of that yourself. Now, sites like Lulu, Smashwords and the mighty Amazon offer anyone the chance to share their words with the world. And instead of costing you money, these days publishing your own work holds out the prospect of untold wealth. With self-published superstars such as Amanda Hocking, Barry Eisler and Hugh Howie blazing a trail. With do-it-yourself authors storming bestseller lists and shifting millions of copies, the industry is starting to take note. We launched a monthly competition to find the best self-published novels at The Guardian in April. But why does a writer decide to take things into their own hands? And how does it feel? For the writer Orna Ross, who founded the Alliance of Independent Authors in 2012, the mixed experience she had publishing novels with Dublin-based Attic Press and global titan Penguin left her ready to try something new.
I was very lucky in the sense that I was picked up by Penguin, Tesco's, you know, that whole model. And while there are fantastic advantages to that and you get front store promotion and all those wonderful things, you also have to make big compromises around things like your cover and title and stuff like that. And I found those sorts of things creatively quite difficult, and also the fact that I was never kind of included in marketing decisions, and being somebody who would really have liked to have been involved in the book from concept to completion, I was quite frustrated within that system. So when self-publishing became available, I decided I'd give it a go. I was a bit sceptical, so I decided I'd put out just a very small chapbook of poetry, because nobody would read that, and so I could make a mistake if I liked it and nobody knew. And I instantly loved it. I instantly realised as I pressed that publish button for the first time that I was doing something really radical, really revolutionary within my world. People bought poetry, not in great numbers, but that anyone, a stranger, had, you know, that had never happened before.
And suddenly there you were, without a pigeonhole.
I mean, it was heady, it really was. So I then decided that I would take my rights back from my publisher, which I did, and I'm now reissuing those books that I originally published with Penguin under the original title and treatment that I had envisaged when I was writing them, and that's very satisfactory. And this year I'm, again in the spirit of experiment, trying to bring out a short book, one a month for the year, which is something no publisher would ever do. So it's that sense of freedom and exploration that I absolutely love.
So how do you think it's changing the industry?
It's changing the industry radically, I think. I mean, my experience, I was at Digital Minds conference here speaking on Monday and talking to lots of people who are working in trade publishing, and they are hampered to a great degree by just the size of their corporation. So a lot of the things that we're able to do as indies are things that are now seeping into trade. So I think it's really about that close bond between the writer and the reader. I think there are all sorts of genre popping up that trade publishing never even knew existed. I think there's a whole movement within the trade to kind of publish and promote the kinds of books that people within trade publishing like to read themselves. When people go indie, things really broaden out very widely, and we've got, you know, I mean, genre that people just never thought of popping up all over the place, and fan fiction. There's this just incredibly vibrant, dynamic scene happening, and trade is monitoring now closely and looking and seeing what's happening and then adapting some of the ideas over. And, you know, so in a sense, it can almost be an experimental place for the entire industry. They can then come in and kind of take what works for them. Check them out. Pick up a book. You got a fantasy. Imagination can take you to where you want to be. Are you curious? How can you find out? Books. Check them out. Books. Check them out. Read about stars and cars. Play electric guitar.
Catherine Quinn had been pursuing a traditional publishing deal for 7 years when her twin sister told her to grow up, to take responsibility for her own fate and publish her fiction herself. After a romantic novel she wrote in only 6 weeks sold thousands of copies in a few short months, the historical thriller she'd struggled to place with traditional publishers for so long found a very different reception.
So the first time around, the feedback I was mainly getting was that because I was a female writer, they were looking for another Philippa Gregory, and my books are historical thrillers, so I kind of wanted them to have all the kind of pace of a really page-turning, easy-to-read thriller, but with this really interesting context of the first book is set in plague time London, so with this kind of zombie town kind of backdrop, and the second is the Great Fire. I would get feedback that was like, we very much enjoyed your writing style, but we just felt we weren't taken into the characters' lives in the same way that we would be with Philippa Gregory. And once I'd sold all of those other romance books, which was a completely different genre, suddenly all the publishers were saying, oh, you know, we really love that they're so unique and they're nothing like Philippa Gregory. You know, it's like a thriller, but it's set in history. But it's like they finally got it, but they only got it in the context of, oh, you've already proven that you can, you know. The Thief Taker book, which was bought by Amazon, is set in plague time London. And then there is a natural sequel to that, which is set around the Great Fire of London, which I've kind of already written because it was one of the ones that didn't get through the publishers. And it was just such enormous fun. And there were like really big scenes in there where the roofs of St. Paul's Cathedral melts and the streets run with lead and all these things that really did happen. That's really exciting. But then I do have my romance books that I still sell. And I wanted to create a format because I was getting lots of feedback that readers were annoyed at series that they got to a cliffhanger and they couldn't read on. So I created a series that was five girls who all started in the same bordello, and then each book is their story, and then each story is based on one of my favourite romance films. And that one was such a difficult one to decide on because I knew I could sell it myself. I'm fortunate enough to have a lot of romance fans and I have their emails, and I could just email them that book and I know it would sell. But at the same time, I could see it doing quite well in a bookshop, actually. My wonderful agent, Piers, is selling that book here, and he's got some really good offers. He's already got four, I won't say who from. I did say to him before he went out, look, it has to be a certain amount of money for me to even really consider, because I know I can make X from this book. I'm hoping that after this book, the same as happened with my other romances, when you release the second book in a series, then you get more and more and more. So if it's popular, you know, it hopefully could do quite well. And it's a nice, you know, historical romance is very popular, and it's an amazing thing for authors to, it's kind of the boots on the other foot, you know, after years and years of being in this incredibly weak position and your only avenue for market was through this sort of bizarre distribution bottleneck who kind of took a lot of your money, and you kind of had to beg and plead before you could give a writer $2,000 and he'd kiss your feet and say thank you very much. And yeah, it has all changed, and that's an amazing thing.
So what are the advantages of going through a major publisher? Number one, no capital outlay. You're not going to be investing the $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, depending on your print run, to get that book out to the market. Someone else is going to be covering all those expenses, and they're going to be giving you a fee, sometimes up front.
Hugh Howey is another author who found success via Amazon after publishing a dystopian thriller in installments on the online shopping site. Wool went on to become a smash hit,
with Ridley Scott snapping up film rights and Howie retaining rights himself to sell the book online when he signed a six-figure print-only deal with Simon & Schuster in 2013. Since then, he's become an outspoken advocate for self-published authors, arguing that we need to focus on writers, readers, and storytelling instead of wringing our hands about changes in the way those stories are delivered. Earlier this year, he published a series of reports assembled from publicly available bestseller lists on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and estimates of sales, which suggested that self-published authors were almost matching the big five publishers in unit ebook sales and earning more in the process. Critics have attacked both his methods and the sweeping conclusions he draws, but for Howie, the data's clear. The industry has already been transformed.
It might be the big five are selling more units than the self-published authors as an entity, but it's not much. Another interesting thing is how many books are being sold by independent publishers. And a lot of the numbers and a lot of the industry, and we're sitting here at the London Book Fair, and all the talk comes from the big five. What are the big five doing? And so we're letting the tail wag the dog. We're letting like 35% of the market be the entire conversation about ebooks. And when people say, well, ebook sales are flattening this year, is that what's being reported by the big five publishers? Because they're a fraction of the market. If we're not counting self-published authors and indie presses and Amazon imprints and all these other people that we never factor into our conversations, then we're making business decisions on an industry by looking at a small corner of that industry. It should be an opportunity for us to learn from each other and for us to grow the entire book market by understanding what's going on. All we want is transparency.
What do you say to those who suggest that you're looking at a small segment of the industry yourself? Just you're looking at ebook sales and you're looking at only one retailer, admittedly a big retailer, but Amazon is only about a third of the books market in total.
Well, we obviously started with the biggest retailer possible. I think it's funny that the people who criticize the report saying you're only looking at Amazon, when you look at everything that they talk about in the industry, it's Amazon, Amazon, Amazon. There's entire panels just about Amazon at these like Digital Book World and these book industry panels, and all people, you know, the keynote speech at Digital Minds this week started off talking about Amazon as the elephant in the room. So you can look at lists on Amazon where print is ranked in with ebook. The ebooks drown out the print books. In some cases, it's over 80% of the ranked books in the bestseller list are the ebooks versus the print. At least half of the physical market is going online. So when we think of online as only being digital, it's not. A lot of people buy their physical books from online retailers. Now, as a bookseller, that's bothersome to me. I worked for years in a bookstore, and I wish this wasn't happening, but wishing is not going to help us improve readership and grow this industry. We've looked at other markets as well, and we're getting the same results. There are other people like Nielsen BookScan that look at sales, and they capture, some people have said they maybe capture 30% of actual sales. And I've seen that with my own print sales. I know when I tour what I sell and then I see what's reported through Nielsen, I know it's not correct. What we're trying to challenge is the problem of not having any numbers in this industry. Readers don't even know that this is not a true accounting. And how can we make business decisions when everyone's guarding our data so closely?
Why isn't Amazon releasing sales figures?
I ask that every time I meet someone from Amazon. I'm like, why can't you release this data? And ask that of all these distributors and from publishers. You know, like, release contracts. Let's see what the contract terms are. I like that with self-published authors, we know what they're making because we know the terms of each online distributor. So if you're publishing with Amazon or Kobo or iTunes, I know exactly what you're making by that list price. And the same should be true for publishers. I wish the back of a book let readers know how much the author's making.
Author Earnings isn't just a research project, is it? You're also trying to drive the transformation of the industry. And what kind of changes do you have in mind?
Several. One thing I would love to see is contracts to compete with what self-publishers enjoy, which is creative control. I think non-compete clauses are damaging to publishers. They don't even know why they have them. There are lawyers at publishing houses that convince them you need to have this.
For anybody who doesn't know, what's a non-compete clause?
When you sign most publishing contracts, when you sign with a publisher, and these are getting more and more strict, it says that you can't publish anything else without the permission of the publisher as a competing product. So you basically have given your writing career over to a publisher. Big authors who are in this often write books in under pseudonyms. People who said, like, look, I can write three books a year. Why don't we publish three books a year? Readers read a lot quicker than we write. Publishers would sell more books if they allowed their authors to publish more books.
These all seem like changes aimed at removing barriers between writers and readers, getting publishers out of the way almost. Are publishers the problem here?
Well, they're not the problem. For a long time, they've been the facilitator, but now we have tools that are making, you know, sending mail through mailboxes would seem quaint. But a lot of what publishers do, it seems like they're faxing each other. For instance, payment. You know, it used to be checks mailed out, so it made sense to do it twice a year. Royalty statements are confusing, but now it's all done by computer. It's all automated. It's all direct deposit. Publishers should be paying authors monthly. And, you know, digital books, they don't cost the same to print. A digital book should not cost more than the paperback.
It's just they need to catch up.
Absolutely. And yeah, they need to really cater to readers and writers. That needs to be their primary focus. What can we do for writers? What can we do for readers? And not worry about what we can do to hurt Amazon or what we can do to help bookstores. And I think it's easy to forget what we're in this for. And we're in it to be storytellers.
Like newspapers, television, and the music business, the publishing establishment already finds itself under pressure from the digital world. The launch of the Kindle in 2007 saw Amazon flinging wide the gates, with do-it-yourself authors listed alongside e-books from major houses, unleashing a tidal wave of new opportunities which traditional publishers are still struggling to understand. Here at the London Book Fair, we're surrounded by the usual clamour of manuscripts being bought and sold. But self-published authors, whose presence at the fair has grown steadily since 2012, are forging new ways of working which challenge old ways of doing business. Philip Jones is editor of The Bookseller.
I think it's changing the way publishers think about authors. It's shown that authors have a good, legitimate and in some cases rewarding route to market that they can never get to before. I think it's shown that authors can be very entrepreneurial, I think more so than publishers ever thought. Obviously, publishers always worked with authors to handle things like marketing and publicity, but I don't think they ever recognised that authors could really play a lead in that. And really, in some cases, do things more smartly, more quickly, more intuitively, more with more innovation than the publishers could. So I think it's been a wake-up call to publishers. Indie authors have been quicker, smarter. They've spoken more smartly, more cleverly with their audience. And the result has been, I think, for those authors who have really mastered this, strong sales and fairly strong sales of, you know, the unknown writers. People like Mark Edwards, who self-published on Kindle, then went to HarperCollins, did less well through HarperCollins, then came back to the Kindle and has sold hundreds of thousands of his latest title.
I mean, can we put some numbers on this? What kind of fraction of the market are we talking about?
We believe of the ebook market, it's around about 20% by volume and maybe half that by value. I mean, one of the things that self-published writers have shown is that if you price very opportunistically, then you can generate huge sales volumes. And because they don't have the overhead of the big publishers, they're making good money out of that. And it puts publishers in a tough place because they do have that overhead. They do need to sell at a decent margin and put a decent price on the ebooks, and it's made them look uncompetitive. So again, you know, publishers have a lot to learn when competing with the self-publishing talent.
What a publishing house, a good publishing house, can offer is incredible expertise in terms of editorial, presentation, marketing, outreach. It's also quite difficult as a self-publisher to be effectively on more than one digital platform. So it's a big ask for an author to be publishing in that way.
Gordon Wise is a senior agent at Curtis Brown and vice president of the Association of Authors Agents. He describes a new world in which writers can road test their work before signing a deal, where authors can publish side projects or tasters themselves to build reader excitement, and where agents can help their clients to find an audience before a publisher is ready to commit. According to Wise and Jade Chandler, the commissioning editor at Little Brown Imprint Sphere, even though writers can publish their own work directly, agents and traditional publishers still have an important role.
People throwing things out by themselves, that is entirely possible now, and millions of people do that, and you don't hear anything about it at all. What the agent brings to the mix, whether someone is self-publishing or not, is again experience, long-term strategy, awareness of actually what kind of genres work, how people tend to like to receive story. There's a lot more editorial work done in-house at an agency now, partly because some of that has been reduced internally at the publishing house. Arguably, you could do without the publishers quicker than you could do without the agents, because I think for someone to publish professionally, you can't do that entirely independently. We wouldn't see the massive uptake that there is at Author HQ here or the recent mini convention there was at the Hospital Club in London. these people want information and knowledge, and that's what you get in a good relationship with an agent.
I'd like to think that we involve our authors at every stage anyway. We would never proceed with something like cover design, for example, without sharing with the author, taking their feedback, particularly if it's somebody we've been publishing a long time or an author who has been published for a long time. They do know their readers well, so it would be foolhardy of us. You get a better end product if everybody's involved in the process from day one all the way through. And that's something we try really hard to do. Putting the author at the centre of the publication process is really important to us.
Do you encourage your authors to have a kind of dual-tracked career, to self-publish alongside the books you're putting out?
I don't think any of my authors do that, but it's not something that I would be completely against. I think there are different audiences for different sorts of novels, and particularly if you're thinking of quite niche fiction within genre crime, for example, or within SF and fantasy, there might not be the kind of mass demand that there might be for a more straightforward part of the genre, for example. So I don't think it would necessarily be a bad thing. I know Kerry Wilkinson self-publishes at the same time that Pam McMillan are publishing some of his series books. So I think it can be complementary. I don't think it needs to be one or the other.
Do you understand some of the anger that there is in self-publishing communities?
You know, the thing that's always cited is obviously Kindle self-publishing and high royalty rates. But there are so many things that traditional publishers offer to authors that Amazon, for example, might not have in such abundance. And as a writer, if you want to have your work published, it's the difference between writing and wanting to publish as maybe a method of self-expression or just for something you feel really passionate about, or perhaps something that's of a more cold and commercial, you know, a cold and commercial outlook. If you have a deal with a traditional publisher, you have a whole team of people at your disposal. Firstly, your editor, who is your cheerleader through thick and thin, and not to mention the marketing, the publicity, translation deals, and people that are really entrepreneurial. I mean, they must be spending hours. They must be, you know, it's like an 80-hour work week just to get your writing out there. And at the end of the day, the focus on the writing is the thing that the readers will connect with when you have a good product at the end of it. So publishers can add value in many ways and save you from working yourself to the bone.
Many self-published authors argue that with the differential in royalties, particularly for ebooks, where Amazon are offering 70% to the author, and then there's an awful lot of money being generated with which you can pay for these kind of services. What is a traditional publisher which brings all of these things together under one roof? What does that offer that you can never get out of paying for stuff yourself?
I mean, maybe it's slightly old-fashioned, but I think a sense of belonging, and I'd like to think that, you know, the authors that we publish at Sphere are, you know, they feel part of the Sphere community. Editors and authors, we're all as one, and I would hope that the prestige of being connected to a list that publishes other great authors is something that motivates people who are also incredibly supportive of other authors on our list. That sense of community is priceless, I think.
The satisfaction of appearing alongside writers such as J.K. Rowling, Val McDermott and Mark Billingham is impossible to quantify. But is it enough to keep an author going when times are tough? Roffs isn't sure.
Now, when we do seminars, you know, a room is full of, say, 100 people, and if you ask them how many of them want to be trade published, you know, a good proportion of them will put up their hands. And I always ask, why? How does that fit with your idea of yourself as a writer, with what you're trying to do for readers? Is it about that, or is it about saying, oh, I've been published, somebody thinks I'm good enough, you know, my mummy would be pleased? That kind of motivation will not sustain you through the real challenges of a writing and publishing life. I always recommend people think very clearly and deeply about why they write, why they want to write, why they publish and why they want to publish, and then think about what's the best way.
So how are publishers going to persuade authors to keep on signing up? For Wise, it starts with the bottom line.
It baffles me that publishers aren't wanting to be more competitive about their digital royalty rates, because there are so clearly very, very strong alternatives. And I cannot believe that they need all of that margin for the development work they are doing, because we're not seeing, after 3 years, incredibly radical and innovative development work.
Where do you think that royalty rate's going to wind up eventually?
50-50 would be fair.
You hear a lot about how books aren't being sold in the same numbers they used to, that print sales are down. But a lot of U.S. publishers are having record profits because digital sales are up, and they make more money on a thing they don't have to print and warehouse than they do on their hardbacks and their paperbacks. So they're making a larger segment of that earning because they're only paying authors 25% of net. That needs to improve. That comes out to like 17.5% of the digital price. We had the same thing happen in Hollywood where writers weren't getting paid for the films that were being streamed and sold digitally online because they didn't know that these rights were important when they sold their contracts. And they had to fight for change in the industry to pay them fairly.
So DRM, for example, you want to get rid of that?
Yeah, digital rights management's a big issue. I think books, e-books should be easy to read on any device you own, and you should own that e-book when you buy it. It shouldn't be leased. So you can copy it to your hard drive, and anything you upgrade to in the future, you move your library to that new device. DRM is easy to crack for the people who want to crack it, so it doesn't dissuade the pirates. It just makes reading difficult for the paying customer.
Yeah, and you also want to get the books out there quicker.
Absolutely. You see this a lot with writers that, you know, are sitting on books and they're having to wait, you know, 1-2 years for the publishing cycle to come around. I think ebooks should be released before the print books. I don't think we should protect print books by holding the ebook back. They used to do this thing called windowing where they released the print book and they would save the ebook for months because they didn't want people to read it like that. They wanted to protect not only books, but they wanted to protect the relationship with bookstores. Let's stop concentrating on medium and retail channels and concentrate on the reader.
Publishers' alarm about the ways in which their books get to their readers is perhaps understandable in a world where one retailer accounts for about a third of the overall market and as much as 80% of UK ebook sales. But Howie's relaxed about Amazon's dominant position.
There could be a danger there. The idea is that they'll become so dominant that they'll become abusive. If that happens, I think that the ease of opening up new markets is now so easy that, let's say that they doubled prices and halved royalties. If they did that, they still probably wouldn't have their prices as high as publishers wanted them initially, and they would still be paying more than publishers are currently paying. But somehow now they're evil for still charging less and paying authors more. But if they did that, they doubled price and they halved royalties, the market would be flooded with competitors who would eat their lunch immediately because there's zero barrier to entry in these markets.
Because it's a digital market.
Well, it's a digital market, but even the online market. I mean, this was Jeff Bezos started Amazon by selling books out of his garage because you can set up a website to do retail. I sell thousands of books through my website, signed books, and I pack them up and take them to the post office and send them out to readers. All I had to do is set up a PayPal account, and then I have a storefront. The barrier to entry is so low. Worrying about what someone might do if they became dominant seems crazy to me. But what we know right now is that Amazon's fighting for lower prices for readers and higher royalties for authors. Publishers are arguing for the opposite, and somehow Amazon's the bad guy and publishing is the good guy.
There's a legitimate case to be made that authors could be treated better by big publishers. I don't think anyone would deny that. But when you're advocating for a solution that takes those big publishers down and replaces it with one even bigger corporate company that has a history of being quite aggressive in this space, that to me would be a little bit of a concern. I think we should all be advocates for all of the options that are now out there, but I think we should be careful about limiting ourselves by being too much an advocate for one solution that is to the detriment of what's really important about the book business, which is a diverse marketplace from publishers to booksellers to authors to agents and finally to the reader. In a sense, the ebook market didn't really exist until Amazon created it, and I don't think we can underestimate the skill and resource and innovation that they put behind it and continue to put behind it. If Amazon went away tomorrow, A lot of publishers would be in financial trouble, but B, a lot of independent authors would find their income streams disappearing overnight. I don't see a company that can emerge quickly enough in that circumstance to replace that income. I think Amazon is in the box seat. It deserves to be. It's pioneered. I would love another company to come through that can do the same things and tap into the same marketplace and create the same reader interest in books, but I don't see it yet, and I think it's naive to suggest that it's easily replaceable.
With Amazon's Jeff Bezos at the tiller, the books industry is headed for the whirlpool of change, a revolution where production and distribution are available to all. But are we looking at a new dark ages or the beginning of a literary renaissance?
Let's leave that one for the historians.
I think it does, in the end, feel to me like a revolution. But the revolution is not necessarily about self-publishing versus publishing. I think the revolution is really about the ability of authors to contact their end reader direct through the internet and through the social web. I think that's the real revolution. I think that benefits everybody, publishers, authors and readers, and even booksellers, if they can get into that space of being a sort of curating force.
I think it's very quaint and short-sighted to say that the only reason this happened is because Amazon did it and Amazon's evil. These are pressures that we're seeing in every retail establishment. They're caused by consumers. They're going to happen by someone. Thank goodness it was somebody who loves books and is a company that seems to value its readers and its writers more than it itself, even.
For the first time since the 1950s, writing fiction can be a workaday job, a 9-to-5. We're not talking about making a killing, we're talking about making a living. And some very fine mid-list writers who would not be able to make even, you know, I think their average earnings were something like £4,000 a year in trade publishing, they can actually make a decent living self-publishing. So I think that's really fantastic.
It's always been a challenge, and it's getting even more challenging because everyone wants to be creators now. The tools of creation are becoming so democratized that everyone's so busy making their own stuff, there's maybe less demand for consuming.
You know, I do believe, and obviously I'm editor of the bookseller, I have a certain vested interest in believing this, but I do believe that the most important element to the book business is its diversity. I mean, I think the real struggle we all face is getting people to read. Actually, I think the e-book and the Kindle and the Nook and Kobo have all helped with that, but there's much, much more to do.
She said to me, look, you need to grow up. You're waiting for a publisher to wave a magic wand, and there's this amazing phenomenon now called KDP, which is Kindle Direct Publishing, and you can go out and easily publish your book, and you can get it onto Amazon within a day, and you'll get feedback from real readers and be selling it for whatever price you like.
I don't worry so much that a big publisher might fall over. I worry what that means to literary culture, because I think it seems incredibly important to me that along with all the genre stuff that sells gazillions, there are books that are very niche.
Well, readers are delighted. Readers love, I mean, within the trade, the thing you hear most from people who work in publishing is the problem of discoverability, because we've got so many books and we've got so many bad books. I don't think that matters. They fall away. When you talk to readers, readers have no discoverability problem. They know exactly how to get the books they want. They are creating new genres, as I say.
It seems to me very important that publishers like Penguin Random House can still publish books that are not going to be profitable in the short term. And the worry is that if that side of the business goes away, it's not the books that get published that we will need to worry about. It's the books that don't get published.
Self-publishing is not for every writer, but every writer should self-publish at least once to see, because you don't actually know what it's like until you do it.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.